Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona, it's time for Valley Business Radio, spotlighting the Valley's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Welcome to Valley Business Radio, where we tell the stories that traditional media tends to ignore. I'm your host, Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and I'm joined in the studio today by Devin Garza and Diane Palacios from Jewish Family and Children's Services. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Diane, tell us a little bit about Jewish Family and Children's Services. You've been with them for a while. Give us a little context on the organization and how you're serving folks.
Jewish Family was started over 85 years ago, reaching out to the Jewish community and serving our families within the greater Phoenix area. And since then, they've expanded. Many programs have expanded. We have a whole behavioral health services. We have child and family solutions. And we serve everybody. We don't just serve the Jewish community. We serve anyone of any faith, any denomination. We have a lot of families that are refugee families that we work with as well as a high Latino population.
Yeah, great. And Devin, how long have you been with the organization? And tell us a little bit about your role today.
I've been with JFCS a little bit over 6 years, and I started as a clinician, and I've moved into a clinical manager position, so I've kind of been able to see all the realms of it. At this time, I am overseeing some of the integration between our primary care into our existing behavioral health clinic. So Glendale Healthcare Center went live about a year ago, and being able to integrate our primary care services within our existing clinic was a really interesting experience.
For sure. And Diane, what about you? How did you get involved personally with Jewish Family and Children's Services? What's your role today?
So I started working with Jewish and Family Children's Service almost 10 years ago. And I started working as a treatment coordinator. And within 3 months, my supervisor told me, you need to go back to school and get your degree in counseling. This is just flowing out of you. This is just natural. You need to do this. So I went back to school reluctantly. I already had a master's degree, but I went back and did a double master's in substance use counseling as well as professional counseling, and was a therapist for several years. And then I became a clinical manager over our adolescent program and our substance use program. And the last year and a half, I moved into a co-director role. And it's been a great place to work. I've got married, got engaged, got married, and had 3 children since I've been working at Jewish and Family Children's Service. So it's been a great place to grow professionally as well as also have a personal life.
That's fabulous. I want to hear more about all of that. And, you know, I think a lot of folks don't always realize the extent to which not-for-profit organizations, community organizations play a major role in healthcare in a variety of communities. I grew up with a mom who was a public health nurse, so I actually went around with her to local clinics and home visits and that whole thing. But create for us a picture of the world that's at play here. In other words, you're both from specific clinics, Devin Garza from the Glendale Healthcare Center, Diane Palacios from the Michael R. Zent Healthcare Center. Give us a sense of what these clinics are doing in those communities and what it's like, a day in the life, if you will. Devin, why don't you start us off?
So at the Glendale Healthcare Center, we see a variety of different families, communities, presenting issues, all sorts of broad demographics. The majority of our clients are under state Medicaid access, so a lot of times we have low-income families, we have a lot of different challenges. Because we started as a behavioral health clinic and have integrated, we really make sure that I'm used to behavioral health with primary care now because I did it so long with the behavioral health part, but we really are moving toward the integrated care. It's really cool seeing newer staff starting. Within the last year, they've only known us as an integrated health clinic. So that's really cool. Being able to identify needs that exist in the community for the whole health approach, for physical health, for behavioral health, for adults, kids, families, foster care, anybody needing any of those services are able to come into the clinic and get their needs met in one place, which is a really dynamic activity that is kind of the way of the future and where healthcare is going.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. We had a conversation in another show with a banker, and in a way, a bank is a similar thing insofar as it touches a lot of different people in different phases of their life, you know, from the little kid who wants to open their first savings account all the way through to people managing their retirement and coming to get money to buy groceries and everything else in between. And it's more than just an institution. It's a part of the fabric of everyday life. Diane, the Michael R. Zent Healthcare Center, tell us a little bit about what you do there and a little bit about the history of the name.
So our Michael R. Zent Healthcare Center, we've been open for about 30 years. And in about 3 years ago, our late CEO passed away, and his name was Michael R. Zent. He was our CEO. And so our clinic became named after him. We moved into a new building in November 2014, and we really love our new building now. We have a pharmacy on site. We have our primary care. We have our behavioral health, and we serve children as a few days old to geriatric population. And so we really are able to meet the needs of any client. It's a one-stop shop. So whoever's coming in, if they have access, Medicaid, Medicare, we're able to provide services and meet their needs holistically and just be able to touch every aspect of their life.
Integrated healthcare as a topic is something that a lot of people talk about, and it means different things to different folks. And I know here in Arizona, or at least I think I know, here in Arizona, there was an effort made to actually integrate the behavioral health services, mental health services with primary care. Can you give us a sense of that, kind of what the history of that phenomenon is, where it's going, and what you see now, Devin?
Diane might be able to correct me on anything I might not have quite accurate here, but there has been integrated care to some extent in certain populations in certain clinics. Like for our seriously mentally ill clinics, they have existed in integration, but it really meant that there's a doctor on site at the clinic. So being able to define integrated healthcare, not just, oh, we have a doctor, check, we have met that need of having them on site. At JFCS, I feel like we've been able to take it one step further to really truly integrate those two things. We have more than just a doctor on site. We have the ability to have people walk up and down the hallways and communicate with each other. We share a medical record, so you don't have to try to get records from your doctor back and forth with your primary care provider. So I feel like the integrated health concept has existed for a while in Arizona. With the state access and the Arizona Complete Care programs requiring integrated health, it kind of put a little bit of a, okay, guys, it's time to get moving on this. But I'm really proud that JFCS kind of saw that coming, I think, and was able to start that process. Like that Michael R. Zent Healthcare Center has been doing this for years. So to really be able to be ahead of the game and be an innovator, JFCS has one of the most just incredible reputations that I've ever heard for a behavioral health clinic. So for us to be on the forefront of integrated for the general mental health population in addition to the serious mental ill population and for kids, that's just an absolutely astounding thing in my opinion.
I mean, it must really change the patient, the client, the human experience as well, to not feel like they're trapped between, you know, bureaucracies that don't talk to each other. Diane, anything you want to add from your perspective? You've obviously seen some of this evolve throughout the years you've been with the organization.
So I think a lot of this is about relationship for our community and developing trust. And our clients come to us, our community comes to us because they trust us. And so they trust us because we've been providing behavioral health at Michael R. Zent Healthcare Center for 30 years and in the greater community for 85 years. And so they trust us to come for primary care as well and develop relationships. So a lot of it is about relationship development. And another point that I wanted to make was our executive leadership team has an incredible ability to see what's coming and start the implementation and start working towards what is coming in the future. And so then that way, Jewish Family's been on the forefront of integrated health because of their wisdom and their leadership.
What changes have you seen, for the patients specifically? And, any examples of a situation where since becoming integrated, you've been able to serve the community in a market? I mean, obviously at the general level, we get it, right? Sure. That makes a lot of sense. You want your primary care physicians and providers talking to the folks who are dealing with mental health, because after all, your head usually is attached to your body, although your mind and your body don't always work together, right? Anything specific that would give some kind of color to the story? Any examples you can share, Diane?
Yeah, so we've had several where our integrated health navigators are key players in this. And so our integrated health navigators are the linchpin or the connection between behavioral health and primary care. We work a lot with specialists and referrals, and we've had a story of one of our clients who was never able to hear. She had lost hearing, and our integrated health navigators worked with the primary care providers and worked with her specialists and were able to get a donation for hearing aids for her. And so she was able to hear the first time. We had a client who was a refugee, and she was a teen. She became pregnant and was thinking of giving up the child for adoption. A week before the child was born, she decided, you know, I'm going to keep the child. And so the integrated health navigator helped her to gather all the clothes that she would need for the child, supplies, actually attended the birth with her for support. And she delivered a healthy baby girl several months ago.
That's amazing. I love that. You know, it's funny because when folks talk about healthcare and services and social safety nets and all these things, a lot of times the conversations are happening in different communities than the benefits are happening at the level of what makes it through to the news or what becomes kind of a sense of, an ideology or a political platform of some kind or another. And at the end of the day, there are hundreds of thousands of people participating in programs that are providing essential services. There's a way in which the physical health and the mental health still are not seen as one, particularly in workplace environments, for example. What perspectives could you share from a community healthcare clinic point of view that would actually help a business or an organization think differently about the way they take care of their people? Devin?
There's no doubt that stigma still exists about behavioral health. And I think to some extent it exists about primary or about physical health as well, that we kind of think of, you know, that one person who always seems to be calling out or, yeah, you know, they have a chronic condition. Why can't they just manage it better? So I think in the workplace, it's interesting. We kind of have a meta level. Our workplace is integrated health, but we also have to consider our staff and their integrated health needs. So being able to consider the whole health of our employees and our staff, we encourage a lot of self-care and behavioral health in services and well-being. We have a really fantastic employee assistance program. So anytime something happens in a person's life, you will always hear someone chime in. Do you have the EAP phone number? Make sure you call. Make sure you get what you need. So we really promote behavioral health, health care, and preventative care, as well as, you know, kind of responding when somebody has a concern. I think that one of the things businesses can consider is just because you don't think it's part of a person's health doesn't mean it doesn't impact their health and therefore their work performance. My productivity is going to go down. If I'm having a really bad day, I'm probably going to feel less likely to come to work. Or if I'm at work, I'm probably not doing a really great job. So we encourage, within our culture, we encourage mental health days the same way we do as sick days. If you have the flu and you're contagious, please don't come into work. If you're having say that you have a diagnosed condition or you're just struggling with symptoms, please don't come into work. Go home, take care of yourself, be with family, do the activities that we know are important for your whole health, because then when you come back to work, you are going to be more effective and you'll feel supported and cared for. And that's employee retention at its best. We keep them engaged and we keep them coming to work. They feel cared about and they feel like people are looking out for them.
That's wonderful. Diane, it's fascinating to me. Now, you're both healthcare professionals. You are... What's the right term here? Help me out. You're licensed
professional mental counselors.
Behavioral health professionals.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah. That's the one. And so you have both the manager's point of view as well as the practitioner's point of view. You know, it's fascinating to me how much kind of mental health and physical health are in lockstep with one another. Physical ailments can cause, you know, disturbed states of mind or, you know, depressed or unhappy or whatever, right? Using the layperson's terms here. And vice versa, you know, mental states can affect physical health. How does this play out in the work that your clinic is doing? And what do you see happening out there in the community? What are some trends or some issues or challenges folks are facing?
So we're seeing a lot of unmanaged diabetes, hypertension, and so we're working with our gaps in care to ensure that we are helping our folks to manage their chronic symptoms or so they don't become chronic symptoms. So then that way, a lot of times high blood sugar can affect anxiety or depression. And if the blood sugar of somebody is off, then it's going to affect their mental health as well. And so being able to treat both, to be able to look at a person in a holistic view and an integrated view and be able to help them manage their their health needs.
We have a lot of opportunities for education about how mental impacts physical and vice versa. And one of the things that both of our clinics have that is really cool is that integrated health navigator role. One of the things we're doing right now is we are running some workshops where we specifically focus on healthy living, but it tends to have kind of an activity related to the behavioral health every single time there's a workshop. So we have managing chronic diabetes. We have managing chronic pain. We have overall healthy living. You might not have anything. You might have a couple different diagnoses, but whatever's going on, there are things that you can do to impact your physical and your mental health. And the best part is we don't even really differentiate. Like I still feel forced to do that just because I come from the behavioral health world, but we really just talk about health, and the word health means all of that. So the whole healthcare really is the model that we're moving toward. And it doesn't even make sense to separate them anymore because they've always been combined together. We've just never treated them that way. So to be able to say we're taking care of your health and mean both things by that, that's really exciting.
Yeah, it seems like that should be a no-brainer.
You think?
Pardon the pun. it should be obvious, and maybe it's not, and it hasn't been. So the trend is heading that direction. Is that broader, obviously, than just your organization?
Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely.
What are the points of resistance in that process? What are the sticking points? What needs to happen or change so that the kind of shifts that you've made at Jewish Family Children's Services to integrate different dimensions of health can actually happen more rapidly?
It's a culture shift. Medical has a different culture than behavioral health, and learning to speak each other's languages. It's almost like an intercultural or a bicultural marriage. It's marrying the two. And they both have different beliefs or different ways that they go about doing things. And so it's learning to work with each other, having a lot of conversations, having an EHR, an electronic health record, that talks to each other so that way our prescribers can see what each other is doing in the system. And I think it takes time. It takes a lot of time, and it can be difficult, but it's worth it. And when you see the results with the client, when you see somebody that is able to be treated and that they are able to have success in their life and be discharged from behavioral health, or behavioral health symptoms have been mitigated due to taking care of the physical health needs, it's worth it.
Mm. How much of this siloing do you think is a result of what you pointed to, which is that the doctors and other healthcare providers who have focused on the body have been trained in a particular paradigm, if you will, that they have inherited from the people who inherited it from the people who inherited it from the Hippocrates or something, right? As opposed to folks in who have been trained in behavioral health, mental health, and counseling and social work and other specific professional paradigms, just have a different background, different training. Certainly a psychologist and, you know, a physician share something in common. They're dealing with humans, but a lot of times what got them to the point of being a professional was a very different career path. What do you think about that, and what's going on now? Is this reaching back into the training and development of the professions?
I think so. I think sometimes it can be fear-based. Well, this isn't in my scope of practice, or there's liability that comes with this. And so that's some of the things that I've heard when we're integrating. And so it's saying, well, why is it outside of your scope? If you're treating this person, how's it outside of your scope? If maybe you don't know, you can call the specialist, you can call the PCP. That's a way to integrate. You don't have to have all the answers. You're not the sole person on this case. And so let's have consultation with each other to find out how we can meet this person's unmet need.
I agree with you. I think that fear is kind of the biggest barrier. So when you asked earlier what some of the barriers can be, I think bureaucracy and funding are always ever present, and I think they will be for the end of time. But on the personal component, a lot of people either feel that their training wasn't adequate, or maybe they didn't have the training at all. And it's interesting being able to talk to the medical professionals and hear their perspective on behavioral health. More often than not, I hear statements, which absolutely no judgment against the people saying it, but they've been taught, oh, that crazy person over there, they're just here to do blah, 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 instead of recognizing this person is here with a legitimate health concern, maybe it's physical, maybe it's behavioral, maybe it's both, we need to further determine what's going on here. So I think we have a really nice opportunity. The two family nurse practitioners that we have at the Michael R. Zent and the Glendale Healthcare Centers, they really embrace that connection between the two. And it helps having them housed in one place, because you'll have some people who are more open to saying, well, call the behavioral professional, call the psychiatrist, see what they want to say, get those records. I'll maybe sort of read them, maybe if I get around to it. We literally walk down the hallway and say, hey, I need to consult with you on this. Or, hey, my patient is sitting in a room. Can you come talk to them? We have that real-time connection walking down. Hi, this is one of our navigators. They can help you with that thing that you needed. So being able to have that handoff, I think, is actually reducing that fear pretty quickly. They're seeing they don't have to be the responsible person. There is a appropriate outlet to get that taken care of. And it's not just kicking the can down the road of, oh, someone else will take care of that. We can take care of it together.
And I think it's a reframing a question is, I can't do this, or well, it's not in my scope. And so we need to start asking ourselves, how can we do this? How can we make this happen, rather than I can't?
You know, it's really great. I mean, so many of the helping professions, in my observation, develop an interesting dynamic between expertise and kind of authoritarian tendencies, where, you know, certainly if you are the one who knows, there's a way of knowing that could be more or less, you know, gentle, right, and engaging. I can't help but think how many different things are involved in creating the kind of environment you're talking about. Certainly the working relationships among the staff and the different folks who are treating a patient, right, a client, a human being in that community. But also the electronic health records. I mean, how much of this kind of integration relies on the foundation of a common place to share the information and pool it? Was that a big shift? And how is that playing out? Obviously, there's concerns that some people have about privacy and various regulations and HIPAA and things. But talk to us about the role that the electronic health records have played in making this sort of thing possible, and any pitfalls that are there as well.
So with electronic health records, our primary care physicians can document, and then our psychiatrists, our nurse practitioners for behavioral health can look in the record and see what they've documented. We also have a health information exchange system. So if our clients hit the emergency department or the urgent cares, that if they have opted in to be a part of the health sharing system, then we can know and be able to contact the client and contact their team, their clinical team, their primary care team, and come up with a plan of how do we help this person? How do we help them with their stability or with whatever they went in for, what the presenting concerns are? How do we address this better?
We have a really strong privacy mindset. We're always trying to consider what is necessary for the coordination of care, but not at the risk of losing that coordination of care. So we have a really fantastic quality management team, and everyone making sure that we're not sharing more than is necessary, and we don't treat people's records just willy-nilly and throw them out there. But being able, my opinion is that having one shared medical record is actually more safe and more secure, because I don't have to have my stuff being sent to the wrong fax number, and Joe Schmo over at Kinko's now knows my critical test results and my other providers didn't. So I think it really helps kind of integrate and smooth a lot of the hangups that we've had. And if, heaven forbid, I had a primary care provider who didn't have great thoughts about my behavioral health, and then they get a communication from my behavioral health professional, maybe they don't care about that. Maybe they don't read it. Maybe they don't look at it. So I think in the past, the biggest pitfalls we've had are lack of coordination, and we pretty much can't have a lack of coordination. You're getting those alerts. You're getting those things pop up in your notifications. We're walking down the hall. We're saying, hey, so-and-so is here. Did you find out about that thing? So really being able to have that coordination. The biggest pitfall I think that we've had is learning each other's. It's all one system, but we use different documents. So there's a little bit of a translation happening. And I love that Diane said the word earlier. We're really just learning how to speak each other's language. And it's happening a lot faster than I expected it to. Just walking on the sidelines, I'm not a medical professional. I'm a behavioral health. So I don't bring the medical component. But to be able to understand these words and how they all play and know what I can get involved in, and then when it is outside of my scope, the appropriate person to hand it off to, our patients and our clients are receiving really high quality services, because there isn't a, oh, I don't know what to do with this and I'm just going to drop it. We make sure that it gets handed off and their needs are getting met.
Yeah, you know, there's levels of this integration as well, isn't there? I mean, there's within the clinic, the communication, the flow of information in the treatment of an individual client, patient, human, there in the clinic. Then, of course, there's communication between clinics and other branches of your organization. And then, of course, there's communication between your organization and the other agencies and providers and institutions and, you know, government offices, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Talk a little bit about how each of you are located in one clinic. Devin, you're in Glendale. Diane, you're in Maryvale, right? Talk a little bit about the relation between clinics in Jewish Family and Children's Services, and then the broader question of how your organization relates to other providers and other offices in the state.
We have a really strong coordination and communication between teams. So each clinic has at least one director, if not two, and they kind of focus on different components. So we don't have one person trying to run everything. Then we make sure that we have a nice kind of process in place for who is responsible for communicating those pieces of information. Diane and I talk regularly. We're calling often about, how are you guys doing this thing? Or, hey, how is this working for you? Being able to really make sure that we're streamlining services for our clients. And we look to meet the needs of our community to the community. I can't think of a better way to say that, but it's all going to be very specific to who we're working with. But in the broad sense, we are talking about people, and we're talking about people with health concerns. So being able to expect some level of continuity as well. If someone were to come from Glendale and go to Michael Arzent, there are certain things that they could expect to be nice and smooth and would happen the same way, instead of feeling like they started all over, have to tell somebody their whole story and are going to get completely different advice. We make sure that we're really in tune and in sync with each other in that way.
Diane, how's it look from where you sit? How different clinics relate together within the organization, and then how the organization relates to the rest of the landscape?
We have regular meetings with each other where we're discussing how to streamline processes. So then that way, what we're doing in one clinic is being done in all four of the behavioral health clinics. So there's a lot of collateral contacts we work with. So we work closely with Department of Children's Services. We work with probation. We work with parole. We work with the Division of Developmental Disabilities as well. And so just making sure that we are providing reports on how our clients are doing, that with the children, we have child and family team meetings, that these key players in the child's life are being invited to these meetings that we're having, so we can ensure that we are addressing every need that this child has. So we work with our stakeholders a lot, as well as we have a family center of excellence at the Michael Arzent Healthcare Center with MIHS. And with that, we are tracking our intakes, and it's helping to prevent the removal of children in DCS custody. So we do a lot of work with DCS.
You know, these clinics, yours and others, I mean, I remember exactly when it was, maybe 18 months ago, I was speaking at the Arizona Association of Community Health Centers, one of their events, and it was on recruitment, retention of qualified providers. One of the interesting challenges, obviously, is that many of these clinics, yours and other organizations, are located in areas that are either remote or may have some stigma attached to them, just the area itself. And of course, then the conditions that you find people in and help with often have their own stigma. You know, it's too easy for somebody on the outside to take a moral lens and look at people dealing with a debilitating health condition, whether physical or mental, but especially mental, as, you know, moral degenerates who, if they only wanted to help themselves, could help themselves, and all this other nonsense. And I feel like the recovery community has done, or at least done something of a good job of trying to educate people around addiction, for example, that addiction is often an expression, a solution to the pain. Trying to find what causes the pain is more important than trying to decide why this is a moral degenerate who, you know, doesn't need help. So there's obviously a lot here. This is a bit of a loaded question, I suppose, but how do you find your organization navigating some of those stigmas, whether they're geographical or, you know, socioeconomic status, or the fact that a lot of folks are on access and other other programs, as well as the conditions themselves. I mean, stigma, let's talk about that.
So our fundraising lunch that we're doing, a Brighter Tomorrow luncheon, is they're focusing on destigmatizing mental health. We've seen it in the news a lot lately, more and more suicides. It's becoming more rampant. It's school shootings. It's becoming, unfortunately, the norm for our societies and our communities to hear about these awful events that are happening. And so it's teaching people and our donors and our supporters and our community that mental illness or mental health is the silent disease. A lot of these diseases or a lot of things that people are struggling with, like addiction or even uncontrolled diabetes or uncontrolled hypertension, these are silent diseases that can silently kill people if we don't pay attention to it, if we don't serve people and support them. I know in Maryvale, where the Michael R. Zent Healthcare Center is located, it's a food desert and there's not many grocery stores there. We partner with Fresh Express to bring our community fresh fruits and vegetables. And so even when you think about a food desert, that a community doesn't even have access to fruit and vegetables that are fresh, that's, you know, people are going to gas stations or the local, you know, liquor store to get some food. And people don't always understand. They think people are on the street or in living in areas because they don't want to get better. Well, there's a lot of structural and systematic changes that need to happen. And a lot of poverty can be generational. And it's not just economic poverty, but it can be poverty of mental health, physical poverty. And so people need to understand that as well.
Yeah, this concept of a food desert, I think, is really powerful. And a lot of people probably have not experienced, a lot of people listening to this station anyway, have not experienced that. It literally an area where, and of course here in the Valley, we're in an actual desert,
right.
But a food desert is defined, and now I'm a cultural anthropologist, I'm not a food economist or whatever, but anyway, defined by the distance you have to go to get fresh food, and that there are huge pockets of our, you know, Phoenix and surrounding cities that are defined as food deserts, where, as you say, the only available calories come from a gas station or an AMPM or whatever it is, right? So the role of these organizations is not just in physical mental health. It's also, do you have an advocacy role in some way? Are you playing a role in trying to change some of these things, conversations and access to healthy lifestyle?
Yeah, so we are doing, in our lobby every week, we are doing health promotion events for our patients and talking about what is it to eat healthier? What is it to... We're taking a topic every week, so it can be diabetes or it can be Domestic Violence Awareness Month or whatever month that we are promoting, we're also teaching about and having healthy snacks. And I think something that's important too is to work with people to cook food that's culturally relevant to them. And so people might not see fruits and vegetables as a main staple in their culture. And so how do we learn about people's culture? How do we learn how to teach them to cook healthy in their culture that still tastes like food that they want to eat, but that's not creating unhealthy eating habits or unhealthy patterns or eating?
Yeah, I mean, you're pointing at the reality of the fact that you're trying to educate, you know, the folks in a community. And at the same time, the lack of access to fresh food is not always entirely their fault. I mean, it works both ways. Markets are transactional. So if people aren't demanding it, it's often not available to buy. So you want to educate them in how to make healthy choices, but also, you know, to be asking, well, can we get this? Can we, you know, bugging the folks and, you know, who do stock and supply the shelves in their area. But it goes another direction as well. The onus has got to be on companies and organizations to actually work against this phenomenon, because it costs everyone and this is something that I think a lot of people don't fully understand. Can you speak to this, Devin? The impact in one community is not just contained in that community. So the fact that, you know, Maryvale is a food desert might affect folks in more affluent communities. Can you speak to some of those inner dynamics?
Definitely. I think that trying to think of all of these things as separate, not my problem, is doesn't do anybody any good. And we see that it just ends up not being the case. Like Diane was mentioning, Maryvale is a food desert. Out in Glendale, we're close to Sun City, we're close to Surprise, we're close to those kinds of locations that don't have transportation. They don't have bus lines. They don't have any way of getting around. So a lot of our clients, whether they are low income or not, if they don't have a working car, if they don't have money for gas, they can't take themselves to the grocery store. You can't get your insurance to pay for a taxi to take you to go pick up your prescriptions or to take you to the grocery store to buy healthy meals, which is ordered by your doctor to help manage your chronic condition. So there's a lot of this belief that, well, it's out there for the taking, go get it. Well, I can't get there, so I can't go get it. So for a lot of people that maybe haven't experienced that themselves and think, well, I mean, it's the Valley. We have this grid system and there's a grocery store on every corner, maybe in your neighborhood and maybe even your own neighborhood, people can't get to it. So I think really just increasing the empathy in considering what other people are going through, putting yourself in their shoes for a minute, really stopping and looking around and saying, what does it take for me to get to the grocery store and buy this healthy meal that I've made? And could everybody do that? And what kind of things might prevent a person from doing that? We don't think enough about the barriers. We just think, people are lazy. They don't care. And that's absolutely not the truth. In our experience, our clients want this and they want this more than anything. And they're really just tired of fighting the fight and not getting the results.
I think it's also about support and learning. It's a lifestyle change almost as well. So I know how many people have ever tried to go on a diet or, it's a new year, I'm going to work out now. Well, if you don't have support or if you don't know how to cook healthy for yourself or you don't have that support at home, then it's next to impossible to know how to do it. You can have the goal and you can have the vision, but without the support, it's you're setting yourself up to fail.
For sure. Now, I'm curious, how did you get into this? I mean, you're both passionate about the subject. You've invested a lot of years of your own professional development, but also your education in this. Wind the clock back a little bit, Diane, and tell us, you know, kind of how did this become where you ended up?
So I've been volunteering in the Maryvale area for 23 years. And it's my heart. It's my heart to see holistic healing here in this community. So I actually grew up in Scottsdale, Arizona. Uh-huh. And when I was 15, I started volunteering at a nonprofit organization in Phoenix. And from there, I think I had a paradigm shift. And instead of seeing children that were whining over what color BMW they got for their birthday, I saw kids and families who couldn't put food on their table. And so it broke my heart. And I knew from then on I needed to be in this community helping out and serving this community. And so I went to college and then I lived in LA for a few years, got my first master's degree in Los Angeles. I learned Spanish. I was working with kids in Phoenix, volunteering with kids, and they were cussing at me in Spanish. And I said, you know what? I don't think so. I need to learn what they're saying. So I decided to learn Spanish. So I went to get my first master's degree in multicultural ministries and Hispanic studies, and I took half of my classes in Spanish. I worked in Skid Row in Los Angeles for several years and then moved back to Phoenix to help start a family group foster home. And I lived with the girls for 3.5 years. And I started working at Jewish Family in 2009. And I ended up going back to school and getting a second and third master's degree in counseling and was a therapist for several years and became a clinical manager working with our adolescent team and our substance use program. And then in the last year and a half, I've been the clinical co-director.
That's great. I was hoping one of those master's degrees was going to be in multicultural cussing.
No, I can do that, but I won't.
I got it.
That was a life skill that she learned. Yeah. She didn't have to go to school for that.
Right. Devin, how about you? How did you get started and how did you end up here?
If you were to ask my mom, she would tell you she always knew I was going to be a therapist. That's just the thing I was meant to do. And I feel like I'm very blessed in that way. I think a lot of people, they either know what they were going to be or they don't. And I think our society kind of expects us to know at like 12 what we're going to be doing. And at 16, we've got to make these decisions of where we're going to college and for why. I feel very lucky that I knew what I was going into. I was either going to be a vet or a therapist. Turns out I can't deal with like blood and stuff like that. So I became a therapist.
I work with integrated health.
Yeah, and this kind of just brought everything together. As long as someone's not bleeding, I'm totally on board. So I went to Arizona State University and got my master's in psychology and sociology. I double majored, and I kind of wanted to go a research route and finding why people do the things that they do. I'm a behaviorist at heart. Turns out there's not a whole lot of opportunity for sociology. So I went the psychology route and found out that counseling was my calling, and community mental health counseling really is the place that I love. I was able to work at some skilled nursing facilities that had dementia units and behavioral health units, and really being able to see the services that can be provided in a loving, caring way. And on the flip side, I saw some really not so great services and what kind of things can happen to our folks that don't have family support, that don't have people to take care of them. They can't live in their own house, so they have to go somewhere else. A lot of these people were really lonely. And so to really be able to consider all of the prevention and advocacy that we need to do to improve our society going forward, but also being able to take care of those people on the back end. So community mental health just is my love. I have a lot of strength in spreadsheets and tasks, and color coding is like my jam. So being able to oversee the launching of the integration of primary care, that was a brand new thing for our clinic. Yes, as the agency, we had some experience, but figuring out how that worked within the Glendale Clinic culture and how it was going to work and problem solving all of it, it's been a really exciting journey.
That's fabulous. What would you say that Jewish Family and Children's Services does differently from some of the other behavioral health providers in the Valley? Do you have a unique stamp or culture or experience that people have when they deal with you?
I think our reputation kind of stands for itself. And a lot of times people ask us why and how we develop that reputation. And I feel kind of silly telling them because we work for it. We work really hard. I think being able to communicate respect. I don't mean to put down any other agency. I feel like other agencies, you're going to have respect and you're going to have people who truly, truly, truly care and have the passion and the desire. I just have never seen so many passionate desire advocate people in one place. And I feel like JFCS does a really good job recruiting those people and then working really hard to keep them. I mean, Diana and I have both been here for an extensive period of time. We have a lot of staff who've been here for decades. I mean, we've existed for over 80 years. So we've got people who've been there for quite some time. People start here and they stay with us. If they realize that this is the culture that fits for them, the integrated health component, this is going to exist anywhere that you go. You might as well be on the forefront of it.
And our executive leadership team has put together a leadership academy. And so they've invested in, I would say, this generation, Gen X and millennials. And so investing in us and helping to teach us and bring us to the forefront of what is happening and what skills do we need to develop as we pave the way to the future.
That's marvelous. Just to wrap up our interview here, any final thoughts, anything you want to share, anything you wish people really understood about your organization and the work that you're personally doing?
We're trying to just make the world better one place at a time. And I think our mission statement actually really kind of well describes that. I know that sounds really cheesy, but our goal is to make the world a better place and make the future better for our families. And a lot of times we focus on the next generation, but we're also making sure we take care of the generation that exists. We have a lot of respect for our elders. So making sure that we consider the people who are here now are being taken care of. I think that's what kind of sets us apart.
Diane?
Like what Devin was saying is we focus with every aspect of a person's life, from birth to geriatric. And so just touching on every person's life and making sure that they have what they need to not just survive, but to hopefully thrive.
And where can people learn more about your work and the work that you're doing at those clinics?
Our website is jfcsaz.org.
Devin Garza, Diane Palacios, I want to thank you both for being here on behalf of Jewish Family and Culture. Jewish Family and Children's
it's a mouthful.
Services. It's a lot of words, but that's what we get to make acronyms out
that's
of, right?
That's right, JFCS.
JFCS is great. So on behalf of JFCS and for all of us here at Business Radio X, this is Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and we'll see you next time on Valley Business Radio.